This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Drs. Rick Bintrup and Miguel Ordonez at UC Berkeley about a policy brief they and Chilean colleagues published earlier this year entitled, What Might Happen If School Vouchers and Privatization of Schools Were to Become Universal in the U.S., Learning from a National Test Case, Chile. At a period in time when both vouchers and privatization have the support of the U.S. Department of Education, it seems important to consider what their expansion from the margins of U.S. schools to an increasingly dominant position might mean for education in this country. Welcome, Rick and Miguel. I look forward to hearing what you can teach us about this important topic. To begin with, could you say something about what school vouchers are and what you mean by school privatization?
Well, when you look at the traditional organization of public schools, you can look at it through the lens of supply and the lens of demand. 90% of students in the United States are still educated in public schools. The private school segment is fairly small and restricted to those families that are capable of paying the private school tuition in the United States. So for all intents and purposes, in many, many communities in the United States, the public school holds a monopoly in terms of supplying education, providing education. When you look at it, the demand side of it, in the traditional organization of public schools, it is the school districts that hold the budget for the students that they school. It is not the parents. Now, if we talk about privatization and vouchers, and we look at it through the lens of supply and demand, through privatization, you break the monopoly of educational provision of the public schools by opening up the market to private providers. That is, those could be organizations such as community organizations, religious orders, for-profit entrepreneurs, and the like. And you allow these private providers to compete with side by side with public schools. When you look at it from the demand side, rather than giving public school districts the budgets to educate the students located in their districts, you give the budget in an apportioned way to each individual family. And so you're creating a market by creating consumers, which are parents, who now hold a voucher in their hands that they can take to wherever they want to go, and you create a supply of multiple providers that compete with each other. So privatization and vouchers are two sides of the same coin.
So what are the proponents of vouchers and school privatization hoping to accomplish through the shift in the nature of education in this way?
I would say the proponents, in my read of the educational scene, group themselves into three types. There are those who believe that the market can fix the problems of running schools like public bureaucracies. And they believe that the meeting of supply and demand through a market will create discipline and efficiencies that public bureaucracies cannot provide. So this is one group. They just believe in the power of the market. Then there are groups that look at public education through the political lens, and they're seeing certain constituencies having power through the institution of public education, for example, teachers' unions and the like. And by diminishing the power of the public education institution, the power of these political constituencies is also reduced. And the third group, I would say, are religiously inclined people who oppose the strict separation of church and state and would like to see public education or the education for their children to be more religiously inclined, and they would like public expenditures to be paying for that kind of education.
It's helpful to really see the division in this way. I hadn't thought about like the religious constituents being such a significant player. Why has Chile become a site where vouchers and privatization have become so well established and for such a long time?
Well, for answering this question, we can, like, there are multiple reasons, but I think three are the key reasons for understanding the pattern. One has to be with the ideas that hold the voucher and the privatization system, then the political conditions, and finally the tacit consensus around marketization across political parties as a way to organize the Chilean society. Regarding the first one, there was a group in Chile of economists who in the previous decades studied economics with Milton Friedman in the University of Chicago. This group was known as the Chicago Boys, whose ideas became the main principles to organize the Chilean society. Through these ideas, Chile reformed the governance of all public services, not just education. So this group was who provided the intellectual base to reform the country and also became they became the guards of this reform over time. This is regarding the first reason. A second reason has to be with the political conditions. In 1981, when the reform was introduced, 1981, thank you. When the reform was introduced in Chile, Chile was in the middle of the dictatorship of led by Augusto Pinochet. So the full reform of the system didn't face any political opposition, neither from people, political parties, or unions, all political forces that were oppressed by the regime. Actually, the entire reform took 18 months to be put in place. Finally, a third reason has to be with the tacit consensus across political parties. In 1990, when Chile recovered its democracy, the center-left political coalition that came to power not only embraced the system, but deepened it by introducing copay and making public the national standardized test as a way to inform parental choice. All the reforms to the system since the 90s to today have been complements or corrections of the actual design, but the principles of the system remain strong.
What can you tell our listeners about the origins of your research project in Chile, as well as the methods you used to investigate this issue? What questions were you hoping to answer?
We started looking at the debate in the United States, being that Miguel and I were or are housed at UC Berkeley. And we were saying proponents and opponents of these policies oftentimes use evidence from fairly peripheral experiments with vouchers and privatization in the United States. And the evidence of these peripheral experiments is just not strong enough to know what would happen if, let's say, for example, a whole state or the whole country were to implement universal vouchers and privatization. We have to look for some test case outside of the country that can help us, despite all the national differences, of course, that could reveal to us some tendencies from which we could learn in the debate in the United States. And Chile is this kind of test case. So we said we have to do something about that. Then we got together with two researchers from the Catholic University in Santiago, Ernesto Treviño and
Cristóbal Villalobos.
Yes. And we said, okay, what do we have available? And they said, a huge trough of studies are available. The reason being that when you have a voucher system, you have to create a detailed administrative data set, national administrative data set, for each child that is being schooled in the schools in the country, and with lots of different information. And this database is accessible to national and international researchers, and it has been mined by many, many, many different studies. So what we then said is, okay, let's mine this trough of studies. And we conducted a what is called systematic review approach, review that was guided by several questions. We wanted to know, what is the effect of vouchers on the middle class? What is the effect of vouchers on disadvantaged groups? What is the effect of vouchers and privatization on the professionalization of teachers? And what is the overall effect of that, or what might the impact be on the nation as a whole? And we searched the studies according to these criteria and selected them according to criteria of rigor. They had to be peer-reviewed, they had to be published by established research organizations and the like, and we ended up selecting about 56 studies that used a mix of qualitative and quantitative research methods. The majority of the studies are quantitative.
So let's go through your questions and discover like what kinds of things you learned as a result of your investigation of these studies. So what was the impact on the middle class of school privatization and vouchers?
Well, I would say upfront, the studies seem to suggest that middle class parents support school choice. They like school choice. They like to find schools in which middle class values and middle class achievement orientations are dominant. And they like being able to insulate their children from the effect of students who might not ascribe to these kinds of values. So school choice is popular in the middle class. And but when you actually look at how school choice plays out once it has become universal through vouchers and privatization, we see some pernicious effects that are not foreseeable in theoretical terms. The bottom line is the choice for the middle class families is limited. Ultimately, it's not they, the middle class families, that choose the schools, but the schools choose them. It's a mechanism that is that should be familiar to Americans when you look at the university system. That is, the more higher status the university becomes, the more difficult it is for students to get in. So families, of course, can all choose Harvard, but only very few people will get in. And this is the same mechanism that plays out in Chile for all elementary and secondary schools in the middle class. That is, schools try, particularly the private schools, try to attract the best possible student crop, so to speak. They try to cream that best possible student population, and they do this with various admissions criteria. They look at grades, test scores. In elementary school, they let, for example, the kids play games, and they watch them play games. They look at family income. They interview parents on a regular basis, and in these interviews, they are allowed to ask private information about the way family life is organized, and they are allowed to ask about religious affiliation. So, through these criteria, they are able to attract the best possible crop of students. Then, a second form of selection is copay, which I think Miguel already mentioned became legal. It was always an informal practice, became legal in 1993. So according to the ability to pay, the school can actually leverage a copay. The copay depends on the ability of the parents to pay. The wealthier the parents, the higher the copay. Now, when you actually look at the effect of these selection mechanisms, and you study them in relationship to standardized tests, you find that if you control for the socioeconomic background of the students selected in this way, you can't find evidence of higher quality as expressed in standardized tests, depending on, for example, copay. So you ask yourself, where does this money go? All this copay that the parents pay. Obviously, it is not translated into better education quality. It goes somewhere else. And if you know that, for example, 50% of the schools in Chile are for-profit, and education and other organizations have an interest in using the funds for all kinds of purposes, not necessarily for the quality of education, you're not surprised that these selection mechanisms don't really lead to higher quality. But what happens is that these mechanisms force the middle-class families into a year-after-year competition game in which you know, families are pitted against each other. And Miguel has an example of how this plays out in Chile.
Well, I can share with you my first-hand experience when I went to high school. I remember that I applied to a highly selective private school when I was at the age of 12. I remember that I went to my mother to this school, and we had to make a really huge line for waiting for me to be tested. I was able to be tested by this school after evaluating my grades. They were accepting just kids with a grade of B+ or higher. So you go state by state, you are selected because of the grades, but then that is not enough. I was tested one day for math, another day for language. Then they interviewed my parents, in the topic of their religious beliefs, because I was a Catholic school. So that was a set of criteria that I was like exposed to, which was super stressful for me as a like student and also for my family. But also I was exposed also to the copay criteria, which it was before the establishment of the copay formally in the Chilean society. So my parents has to pay a copay of like $20. And I remember that the school gave a receipt saying that it was a voluntary contribution to the school mission made by my parents. So the copay mechanism was already established and then was formalized. But in personal terms, I went through both.
So both testing, interview, and the copay were used to make sure that people like you would get in and other people would be excluded.
Absolutely. So, and that was a really strong mechanism for like separating the lower middle class, which was my family, the family of my, in the case of my family, from the actual lower class. So you can see in the group of kids that were like selected that school, that like class segregation.
So, you know, in summary, we can say it's true that families can choose where to apply, but schools are the ones who can and do discriminate among applicants based on the criteria that we were mentioning. In effect, the private sector has given rise to socially homogeneous schools that are finely differentiated according to lower and middle class status and according to strata within each class as determined by social, economic, and cultural capital.
So it sounds as though this process has really dramatically increased the competitiveness that families have to engage in to gain access to educational goods. And so that the competition is not only between schools seeking students, but for students seeking the best kind of education that they can receive. What about the impact on economically disadvantaged students?
Well, the mechanism is fairly similar in that within, so one has to understand that particularly in urban areas, not unlike the United States, geographically, social classes are highly segregated from each other. But within these segregated areas in which the lower classes live, the same kind of sorting mechanism plays out that we described for the middle class. So it is there as well that you have a choice, particularly in the urban areas. In the rural areas, it's a different situation. But in the urban areas, poor people have a choice. And they will try to get the best possible choice given the copay that they were able to afford. But with one difference, and the difference is that about 20% of the student population have nothing to put up to shop for school. Those are the poorest of the poor. Those are immigrants, special education students, and the like. That is the most kids from broken families. Those all go to the public schools. The public schools cannot reject these kinds of students. As a result, the public schools have the reputation of being the schools of last resort. So the result is that while public education educated about 80% of the students in the 1980s, public education has now shrunk to 36% of the students. And in the cities, it is about 20%. So public education has shrunk despite the fact that the center-left government has tried many, many times to shore up public education by increasing funds and the like. Once the competitive dynamics are being put in place, both in the middle class and in the working class, in among disadvantaged populations as well, what you have in the end is a bottom rung that is associated with the public option.
So one of the most striking things I took from your article is the way school privatization is leading to deepening divisions across socioeconomic groups in Chile. Could you say more about this and its impact on public life?
There is a really very interesting fact about the effects on the poorest in Chile. For instance, if we take Santiago, which is a really segregated city, especially for the lower class, you can see that the already segregated neighborhood, the school competition within those neighborhoods create even more segregated schools in terms of the composition of the socioeconomic status. So we can see like the discriminatory patterns of the voucher system within like poor neighborhoods, making the segregation and discrimination even harder.
You assert that once school privatization has become well established in a society, it's very difficult to change. What have you seen in Chile that has led you to basically make that assertion?
Well, we can see that in the last, I would say, 10 years, the center-left government that was in power, seeing the pernicious segregating effects of the system, tried to attenuate the negative consequences of the system with various policies. As a result of a very strong social movement that brought millions of students into the streets, that claimed that the system was socially unjust. Millions of students year after year after year is one of the most enduring social movements in Latin America. The center-left government responded to this movement and tried to attenuate the worst consequences of the policies by abolishing copay, by outlawing admissions criteria, just to name two things.
For-profit education.
For-profit education. Though the for-profit schools were grandfathered in, we're seeing strong resistance against these kinds of policies, obviously on the part of the owners of the schools who have a business model that they want to maintain. And it's a very strong interest group affiliated with certain political parties. But also, and this is important, we have a strong interest on the part of parents to maintain this system, because what the government has seen when they outlawed admissions criteria, that the schools found, informal ways of maintaining the admissions criteria, even though they were outlawed, until the government finally said, okay, every student is going to be assigned a place in a school according to a central national lottery based on their first, second, and third choice. This is not something parents want, many parents want, because it means that they might lose out on the competition. So Parents don't want to be at the mercy of some central lottery. They are very opposed to that, and they want to ensure that they ascertain the best possible education for their child. So as a result, you have a confluence of the business owners on one hand and parents concerned about losing out in the competitive rat race. You have that mix of political forces, and it's very hard for a center-left government to resist those forces.
In the U.S., even though Betsy DeVos has not had much success in getting Congress to support her own school privatization agenda, what's your sense about the future of similar forms like for-profit charter schools and vouchers in the U.S.?
Well, it's hard to imagine. I would start from the assertion that although we have a discourse of public schools being a failure in the United States, your average public school in this middle class suburb is a grand success case and internationally seen as a success case. When you look at test scores, states like Minnesota and Massachusetts, where these kinds of schools are prevalent, these states perform at the level of Singapore and Korea, the top countries in the world. So the system is not broken. So if I have a choice as a parent living in a community in which my school is supported, my public school is supported by public tax dollars, and the school is open for my child, and my child is educated in a solid school, why would I opt for a public voucher system, for a universal voucher system, in which I have to enter a competitive race that is similar to the way middle-class families apply for college? Why would I want to have that? And so, you know, given the groundswell of public support in middle-class settings, I would say the prospects of privatization, unless a strong religious argument is added to the equation, is probably not going to become very popular in the United States. If the warnings are heeded from countries like Chile that show how pernicious the effects of a universal voucher system can be.
Well, many thanks, Rick and Miguel, for the work you and your colleagues have invested in revealing the consequences of school choice, vouchers, and privatization. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. January's Education Interview of the Month will be with Professor Susan Ex of Indiana University and Julie Mead at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They have recently completed their own policy brief on school privatization and discrimination in U.S. schools, adding to the collection of podcasts, including this one, that have explored the financial impact of charter schools, voucher workarounds like educational savings accounts, and the failure of these and similar reforms to truly address U.S. efforts to equitably educate all of our children. I invite you to join us again for another podcast.